I'm going to introduce the next topic and our speaker, Larry Smith, a FASB board member. A little background. At the July SAG meeting, we had some discussion about the volume and pace of the standards. In the October SAG meeting, we focused on a few specific standards. The end of January, the FASB comment period closed on the effective date and transition methods discussion paper. And today, Larry is going to talk a little bit about on the update on the FASB standard setting agenda, the implications of the volume of things that they're facing, and some of the changes going on with the different standards. And appreciate Larry coming here today. I've known Larry for quite a few years. He's the one, many of you know that I used to be an EITF member. I remember it was about 4.5 years ago that Larry called me and said, Jay, do you want to be an EITF member? I'd express the interest, and I said sure. And so we've commiserated long and hard about lots of things in the EITF and other things, including the codification that Larry was instrumental in. So I will turn it over to Larry for about 20 minutes of formal presentation, and we'll fire away some questions at him. So go ahead, Larry.
Thanks, Jay. And the EITF's loss is the PCAOB's gain, so good luck. Slide two, I'm sorry, I have to, the remote didn't work from this distance, so I'm going to have to tell you when to switch. But slide two is the typical disclaimer, so these are my views, only my views, and not those of the FASB, et cetera. What I'd like to do, as Jay indicated, is provide a little overview of where we are, what our objectives are, what things look like in the near term in terms of the various projects that are on our agenda and where they sit, and then talk about what we refer to now as the big four standards that we're working on with the IASB, and touch upon some of the issues that I raised in July, I guess it was, and issues relating to increased auditor judgment and how we've addressed some of those issues in redeliberations. This slide here really just is a general overview of what we're really trying to accomplish as we work on specific standards with the IASB. And very simply, you know, we're trying to take existing U.S. GAAP and improve the standards and converge them. The IASB is trying to take their standards under IFRS and improve them and come up with a high-quality global set of accounting standards. The next slide, however, touches upon how we deal with this, because part of the struggle at the FASB, and I'm sure at the IASB, is how do we come up with a converged set of high-quality standards, and do we sacrifice what we think is a high-quality decision for the sake of convergence or not? And the FASB members struggled with this for a while and finally decided on a hierarchy, which our Board of Trustees agreed with, and that is that our priorities in standard setting and working with the IASB should be as follows. First and foremost, that we should maintain our independent due process, all right? To the extent that situations provoke us or might provoke us to shortcut the method or what have you, we feel we should step back and say, you know something, we can't go there. We need to maintain our independent due process. The second priority is to improve financial reporting in the United States. Okay, so to the extent that we have decisions and we feel that certain decisions just are not an improvement in financial reporting in the U.S. or are not implementable because of certain specific reasons, that we should fall back to really assessing what the impact is on the U.S. And then finally, the third item is to reach consistent answers with the with IFRS. So that's the hierarchy that we try to keep in mind as we make decisions. Next slide. I will not talk at this time on the four that are in pink or orange or whatever color that is, because those are what we consider to be the big four. That's where we are spending the bulk of our time right now in deliberations with the IASB, and I can tell you that those deliberations are ongoing practically 3, sometimes 4 days a week from now until I'm not sure exactly when. We are in an extremely accelerated mode that I don't think standard setting has seen before. That being said, and I know there's significant concern in this room, outside this room, about the pace of change and the pace with which both we and the IASB are addressing these standards. And you read a lot, particularly when Sir David is being quoted, about the June 30th deadline, et cetera. The FASB continues to view June 30th as a target date for getting these projects done. We do not plan to make any decisions or shortcut any analysis that's necessary in order to achieve a June 30th date, but it still remains a target. One thing that people can feel comfortable with is if we were able to reach June 30th with all our substantive decisions and actually, let's say, publish staff drafts of new standards for these four projects, the FASB still has to take those agreed upon standards and convert them into a codification, changes to the codification. And we have committed that we will expose those changes to the codification. So if best of all worlds in terms of dealing with these issues, if we came up with those standards, post June 30th, our staff would have to go through and make the required changes or proposed changes to the codification. We would then expose them so everybody knows what the consequential effects of our decisions are. And there are times through that process that we learn some things. And to the extent that we learn some things, I guarantee you that we would not ignore them. So that's just something that would be coming down the pike if we were to meet certain targets. Real quickly, I'm going to try to bring you up to speed with where we are on some of these issues on this slide. Consolidation, we had issued 167 more than a year ago. The IASB then took the principles of 167 and effectively incorporated it into a principle consolidation model that really was applicable to both variable interest entities as well as voting interest entities. They exposed it and then started to re-deliberate. We re-deliberated with them and came up with a series of decisions. And they then formed a staff draft, which was very close to a final. What we did was we exposed that last fall, I guess it was, to see what how U.S. constituents would view it, because there was one fundamental difference in that consolidation standard versus what we have, and it pertains to voting interest entities. As you all know, we kind of have a 50.1% voting interest model in terms of having control. They have an effective control notion, which enables you to consolidate somebody if you have control but are holding less than 50% of the shares. We exposed it and received very negative reaction from both the user and the preparer and auditor communities here in the U.S. We held a roundtable in December. The views expressed by people that responded were very consistent with the views that were presented back in the mid-90s when Denny and his crew exposed something similar to that. So we were not surprised. We reported those results of our outreach here in the U.S. to the IASB to see whether they wanted to change their mind or change their proposed standard at all. And they decided that they did not want to change it. So here we are. That kind of put the ball on our court as to what we wanted to do. And we said, well, we really don't want to change U.S. GAAP now to reflect the change in the voting interest model. So that's where we are with respect to consolidations. Discontinued operations, there's both the IASB and the FASB have agreed to change the definition to effectively take the evaluation of a discontinued operation up to a higher level. And we plan on issuing an exposure draft, I believe, in the second quarter of this year. Emissions trading, we have really postponed any further deliberations of emissions trading until we get through with the Big Four, so I don't anticipate anything coming out in the near term. Our tech plan says, and it, some type of a document to be exposed in the fourth quarter, that might be a little optimistic in my view. Financial instruments with characteristics of equity. Basically, the IASB and the FASB exposed a document that did not receive very positive feedback. We went back to the drawing board to see if we could pull ourselves together a little bit closer. At the end of the day, the IASB really didn't want to change their model all that much, so we kind of put it on hold and said, well, let's wait until the Big Four are done to see what we want to do. My take is that the IASB probably doesn't want to move very far off of the model that they have. Whether we want to make certain, let's say, tweaks to our model to try to deal with some of the specific implementation issues that exist remains to be seen. The difficulty is that there it really, using the fundamental model we have now, results in a fairly rules-based system that's fairly complicated. The SEC is, this is still an area where there are significant restatements, particularly among the smaller public companies, and I sense that that might just be because the larger firms have their subject matter experts, and when there's a liabilities and equity issue, it goes to them and they can deal with the issue, and sometimes the smaller firms don't have that breadth of experience, and it's not that anybody's trying to do anything wrong, it's just that they are very complicated standards. I have been somewhat on a, I don't want to say a war path, but I've tried to encourage us to do something at least as it pertains to the codification, because if you try to read the codified financial instruments with characteristics of equity section, it's almost illegible. I mean, and it really is a function of the fact that it took a bunch of pieces of literature and put them together, and I'd like at a minimum for us to at least rewrite that so we have a starting point and something that people can understand. Financial statement presentation, really we completed some outreach on our staff draft. At the end of the day, we have a lot of good feedback, and we've kind of just put that on the shelf and said, okay, once we have some more time, let's consider that feedback. Maybe it's a full-blown project on financial statement presentation as it was. Maybe it's taking pieces of it and breaking them off into smaller projects. Not sure, but we have a lot of good feedback in terms of how to move forward once we get through the issues we're dealing with. Fair value measurement, there'll be a final amendment to 157 coming out very shortly. There's a ballot draft on my desk back in the office. Most of these changes, we believe, are fairly minor, and really, unfortunately, they look major because we changed a lot of words so that the IASB's version of 157 and our version are almost identically written. But that will be coming out shortly. And I think that's it on that slide. Next slide, please. Okay, now on FASB-only projects, troubled debt restructurings, there'll be an ED coming out within a couple of weeks at most, which basically provides some interpretive guidance into how to determine what is and what is not a troubled debt restructuring, because with the increase in restructurings, there's been some diversity in terms of how people are interpreting those words. Disclosure of certain loss contingencies, we kind of put that on hold last fall when we found out that our second exposure draft didn't receive quite as much positive feedback as we were hoping it would. And really, we're waiting. There have been a number of letters that have gone out from the SEC emphasizing the need to make robust disclosures under FAS 5 with respect to contingencies. We're waiting to see the results of that. I can tell you that in looking at some of the large financial institution disclosures, there have been some increases in disclosures that weren't there previously. So it will be interesting to see the SEC's assessment of it, and then we'll make a determination as to whether we think this is really an implementation issue with respect to FAS 5 or whether we think we need to do something else. Disclosures about an employer's participation in multi-employer plan. The major problem or the major criticism of our proposal with respect to that, because companies that participate in multi-employer plans do not have a lot of disclosure regarding those plans. The major complaint was about the requirement to disclose the withdrawal liability. People are saying that that's really an irrelevant measurement and therefore shouldn't be disclosed, and we're working with people that actively participate in multi-employer plans to come up with some alternative disclosures. Investment properties is really a project to consider whether we should require fair value measurement for companies that invest in real estate investments primarily. It's kind of a convergence project because really the IASB has an option that allows people to account for these at fair value, at which if you do account for a fair value, it takes you out of the proposed leasing standard we have, and the real estate properties in the U.S. are basically asking if they can do the same thing. We're in the process of looking at it. There aren't very many board members that support an option in the U.S., and now we're trying to work through details to effectively get something similar to the IASB but not have it as an option. The disclosure framework is a relook at disclosures in general. I can tell you the staff is working on it, but there's nothing that will be coming out shortly on it. Disclosures about risks and uncertainties in the liquidation base of accounting, which previously we referred to as the Going Concern Project, started with the codification, really. And really what we were going to do was take a cut and paste of the going concern literature and the auditing literature and put it into the accounting literature. The project has taken on a life of its own such that it's really gravitated to something that we consider less to be a consideration of going concern and more to be a project about what disclosures should companies be making as their ability to continue as a going concern becomes more questionable. So it's a little bit like the risk and uncertainties, SOP, I don't know, 94.6 or whatever number it is. In terms of its flavor, as Marty indicated before, we have been working with both the SEC staff and the PCAOB to try to reflect their comments. We have a staff draft, and I think we have some future meetings among the PCAOB staff and the SEC staff to talk about it further. This is an interesting one. It's something that should be very relevant to the extent that we go forward with it to this group because there are major implications in terms of the qualitative statements that companies are expected to make and at what point in time they are expected to make those qualitative statements. So this is, an area of increased judgment on the part of both companies and auditors. And goodwill impairment assessments came onto our agenda really as a private company matter. Private companies were very concerned with the amount of time they spend doing fair value assessments for goodwill impairment assessments, and we looked at whether we can come up with some qualitative assessments that would be less costly than a fair value assessment to evaluate goodwill impairments. We've since decided that we'll expose a document and it will relate to or be applicable to both public and private companies, because this is not just a private company issuer. Okay, next slide. Thank you. In terms of the transition and effective date discussion paper, I think Marty or somebody mentioned that the exposure period ended a little while ago. We received roughly 120 or so comment letters. The ISB received about 150. Some of the feedback was to be expected, and that is that implementation is going to be pretty costly and time-consuming, that some of our proposals in RevRec and leases, et cetera, will have a broader impact on business in terms of, tax arrangements, regulatory arrangements, borrowing arrangements, et cetera. And a number of people have supported earlier application. Next slide. In terms of views that are different, the implementation approach, meaning whether you implement these in a single date versus a sequential Chinese water torture type of approach. Interestingly enough, the IFRS constituency basically supports a single date. And I think if you look at it, to the extent that it's European-driven, Europe adopted IFRS all at once. So, therefore, a big bang to them doesn't seem to be that big of a deal. In terms of the FASB responses, basically it's split, roughly 60-40 or what have you. So I'm not sure exactly how we'll evaluate that, and it will be nice to hear your views. The document goes through the various transition methods that at least provisionally were being recommended for the various projects. I think for the most part, the IASB type respondents supported what was in the document. The views of U.S. constituents were much less supportive of some of those implementation methods. Okay, next slide. All right, now what I'd like to do is just address some of the items that I highlighted as key judgmental areas in the July meeting and talk about what we've done. In terms of the project on financial instruments, skipping down to the third one, core deposits at current value or some notion of current value, we've since decided that we'll basically keep deposits at what they are today, cost plus accrued interest. The liabilities amortized cost exception really goes away with our decision that we would basically record our liabilities at amortized cost. Liabilities other than derivative type liabilities, that is. We have not changed the no probable threshold in terms of impairment, so still there will be no threshold like there is today under U.S. GAAP. And the last two items we have not addressed. Many of you hopefully are aware of the fact that impairment seems to be really the key area where there's at least an opportunity for a greater opportunity for the FASB and the IASB to get on the same page. The problem is the IASB and the FASB are looking at impairment very differently. Our starting points are almost opposite ends of the spectrum, and what we came out with was a proposal to basically introduce some of the concepts in the IASB's view of impairment, some of the concepts in the FASB's view on impairment, put them together as really a compromise. And the supplemental document that we put on our websites basically indicates that this is a result of a compromise. And right now we're out talking to people to see what their views are, whether this is implementable or what have you. Thus far, it's interesting. This is a very geographic issue. The people that we talk to overseas understand the IASB's part of it, and they don't understand our part of it, which is, that you should record a reserve based upon the losses you expect in the foreseeable future. They don't understand the concept of foreseeable future, et cetera. And the U.S. constituents that we talk to don't understand the time proportionate amount that represents the IASB's piece of it. So, effectively, we've confused everybody in the world. Except. It seems like there is support from the banking regulators. Next slide. In terms of revenue recognition, we've made a number of decisions on this project, and I think if you go through it, you'll see that we've taken the comments seriously, but yet we're still struggling with some of them. Yesterday is a perfect example. We dealt with the concept of contingent consideration, so variable payments under a revenue plan, and had to deal with that. We had a discussion for 4 hours on three different papers, and we reached absolutely no decisions whatsoever, which might cause some people to pause when they think about the June 30th target date. But I think we've done a lot in terms of when to combine and separate contracts. I think when you take a look at some of the concerns that were expressed about revenue recognition for service contracts in particular, and people not understanding the notion of transfer of control as it pertains to service contract, I think you'll see that I believe we've effectively dealt with them, and we're out talking to the construction industry, et cetera, to see if they agree with our assessment that we've kind of dealt with some of their issues. So hopefully in RevRec we're headed towards something, although contingent consideration is something that remains. In terms of leases, we've dealt with a number of the issues. Some of them were, you know, options to renew or cancel, where effectively you'd have to look at all of your potential options in the future. Now we've basically said, instead of that, if there's, it's basically a model similar to what we have today, and that is, if you have a significant economic incentive, then you should consider those as a part of your lease obligation and your lease asset. If not, then you don't have to. And in terms of reconsideration events, you really just have to assess whether there are events or circumstances that have occurred to cause you to reassess. So, for example, if I have a lease, 3 years left on a lease with an option to renew, and I go out and put a significant leasehold improvement, that might create a significant economic incentive for me to renew that lease. Contingent rents, we've also changed the threshold for assessing contingent rents, and really, you know, under the decisions we've made, basically you would have a probability or a high probability threshold for considering contingent rents. That was not the case in the ED. Separating leases from service, we're still working on that. We're really looking at the indicators of value to assess the service components. So to the extent that you can figure out that if you have a lease with a certain service related to it, you look to the marketplace to try to determine that component of the lease agreement, and that would not be considered a part of the amount that you would capitalize, because there was a lot of feedback that we were capitalizing too many executory type arrangements in the proposed lease standard. I say that's about it. I mean, I think a number of the significant judgmental areas have been addressed, but yet I'm not going to sit here and say that there isn't a lot of judgment still going to be required, but I think we've gone a long way to helping people. I found it interesting this morning that when you started, I think it was Barbara that indicated the increased amount of judgment that exists in accounting standards, and I think the implication at least was that maybe we need to go tone that down a little bit and go back to something that is quote-unquote more auditable or what have you. And it really sounded like the principle-based versus rule-based discussion was going to start all over again. So I wasn't quite certain about that. Anyway, Jay.
Larry, thanks. Thanks for your presentation. We're going to let SAG members ask questions of Larry, And well, before we get into the briefing topics that were in the briefing paper, and while SAG members are formulating their questions for Larry, let me just start off with one you touched at the beginning of your presentation about the four projects. And I note, like on revenue, leases, and financial instruments, the boards in their redeliberations have made a number of changes. And you had alluded to a commitment as you get to June 30 to re-expose in terms of the codification. And I guess the question is, some of the changes you've made in the projects have been in response to comment letters. Others have been in response to convergence issues. But am I understanding you correctly that when you get to June 30, is there the possibility of re-exposing, for example, on a standalone basis, revenue recognition for some of these issues that you mentioned that you talked about even yesterday? Or what are your thoughts on re-exposure of the exposure drafts as opposed to exposure of the codification as we get to the June 30 deadline?
Okay, well, any decision to re-expose a standard is usually made when you've completed your redeliberations. So I think it would be too early for me to specifically comment on my views about re-exposure of a proposed standard. That being said, let's assume that we decided not to re-expose revenue recognition, for example. The exposure of the codification amendments would be done from the perspective that we would want people to reflect upon whether we made the appropriate amendments to the codification that reflect the decisions made in the standard and whether we had captured them all. So that's the context in which the exposure of the codification would be made. That being said, we would have to also at least make available to people the full-blown revenue recognition standard so people would be able to evaluate whether the codification amendments were appropriate. And I can tell you based upon my experience that even when you try to lead people to what they should be commenting on and saying, please only reflect on the codification amendments, we might receive a comment or two on the basic decisions. So, and to the extent that those comments cause us to pause, you know, I can't predict what would happen.
Okay, thanks.
Hopefully I wasn't too subtle in my...
I appreciate the answer. I want to open up the floor to questions. I have to note I did promise Larry that, similar to our July meeting, that we would try and focus the questions on the judgment issues and the auditability issues as opposed to particular comments or criticisms on the accounting model. And with that, let me recognize Jay Hansen, who has a question.
Larry, I appreciate the slide that you had talking about the guideposts for these convergence projects of open, transparent process, getting the U.S. Interest first, and then converging as number three. And I know your chairman, Leslie Seidman, has made some comments recently at a speech about it was the impairment model, for example, that effectively that we're not going to converge for the sake of converging if we don't agree. And yet at the same speech, Sir David was emphatic about the need for movement to IFRS and the fracturing of the global coalition to get there. It's a huge elephant in the room, obviously. Do you have any personal thoughts? I realize you can't speak for the board, but personal thoughts on where you think this is going to go?
I'm pausing because I really don't know.
That's fair. All of us are raising those same questions.
You know, I can tell you that we're at the point that we are board members could not work harder than they're working right now. Staff members definitely could not work harder than they are right now. And we all feel badly that we're pushing our staff like we are, because I think, you know, not only our staff, but constituents. I mean, I think Marty and others have made the point that people are having difficulty keeping up with us, and I can totally understand that. At the same time, I think it's important for the FASB to demonstrate that it's doing its best to try to come up with a set of high-quality converged standards and not be viewed in the eyes of the world as being the laggards that just can't deal with it. However, our goal is to issue standards that are implementable with a minimum amount of implementation guidance required subsequent to the effective dates of those standards. And if we don't feel we're there because we didn't have the time, because we, you know, some things came up through discussions with constituents as we make decisions, then as far as the FASB is concerned, and I'm talking for myself, but I know that all of the board members have the same view, we're not going to come up with those, you know, finalize something if we feel that there are fatal flaws in it, you know, when we reach that day. So we're trying our best, but at the same time, we're sticking by our guns in terms of accomplishing those objectives in terms of the priority that I set out. But I can't predict it, Jay.
Barbara Roper.
Since you commented on my earlier comment, I wanted to clarify a point. This was not actually an attempt to reintroduce the issues of principles versus rules-based, but to suggest that if one of the reasons that audits of financial institutions in the recent crisis were so unhelpful in identifying problems is that more of the issues that are covered by the audits are subjective or judgment-based or qualitative, and auditors currently aren't necessarily doing a very good job of that, and I started this sentence with an if, then we need to understand that, and the PCAOB needs to understand that. They need to understand what, if anything, can be done to improve the quality of audits related to judgments and principles and subjective standards. And then I would suggest as a second point that to the degree that the PCAOB finds that certain accounting standards are unauditable, there needs to be a fairly formal input from the PCAOB into FASB. But so it's not an issue to refight an old debate, but simply to learn from recent experience so that we can make sure this process works better if this is the world, if this is the direction that we're moving in. But I would add a second point on the issues of principles-based regulation, which is that industry support for principles-based regulation evaporates quickly in an environment when someone suggests that they might be held accountable for complying with a principle. And that part of what has been lacking in the financial crisis is any willingness to hold people accountable for, so far, in any transparent way, for things, conduct that looks highly questionable. So if we are going to move in this direction, I also think it needs to be backed by a much greater willingness on the part of regulators at the SEC and the PCAOB to hold people accountable for how they comply with those principles, judgment-based standards.
Larry, did you have a response to that?
No.
Okay, that's fine. One of the things I wanted to respond, Barbara, you know, Jim and Marty had noted our increased efforts in working with the SEC and FASB, and one of the things that the foundation that oversees the FASB is started, as you may be aware, is this post-implementation review of the proposed standards. And part of those efforts that Jim and Marty alluded to is the PCAOB staff involvement with that post-implementation review, so that in terms of, you know, what we're seeing in inspections, that type of information, you know, we'll be communicating with the FASB and the SEC. So just wanted to.
And I think that's great. And I would just say some pre-implementation review. I mean, once you're at post-implementation, you're a little late in the process. If there are issues you can identify earlier on that are likely to be problematic, that past experience in other areas indicate are likely to be problematic, we would hope that that input is being provided in the front end as well. But I think it's terrific, the kind of feedback that you are getting into the process.
The FASB provides us with fatal flaw reviews, and we monitor their process. So it is both pre and post. So next, Denny Beresford.
Larry, we have a separate agenda paper dealing with disclosures, and it refers to two separate proposals outstanding right now, one on revenue recognition and one on derivatives. And just to quote real briefly, the revenue recognition says that an entity shall consider the level of detail necessary to satisfy the disclosure requirements and how much emphasis to place on each of the various requirements. In other words, make a judgment as to how much you think should be disclosed. And the other one has a similar one, determine in light of facts and circumstances how much detail it should be required to disclose. That's quite a different approach, I think, than the FASB has typically taken in the past. First of all, is this something that the FASB has sort of chosen as a new approach to disclosure requirements? And secondly, can you recall any reaction that you may have received, at least to the revenue recognition? I think you probably haven't received the comments much on the on the second one yet.
those general words, it's kind of interesting. I think we kind of took from an existing IFRS disclosure requirement, and we've tended to put in words similar to that in a couple of proposed standards where we say, you know, give us enough detail so that people can understand it, but don't give us so much detail that you're obscuring the facts. You know, and Bob Herz, when he was chairman, used to like to call it the, not too much, not too little, just right type of thing. And I guess what we're trying to do is while we prescribe specific things that should be disclosed, it's difficult for us to prescribe the level at which those details get disclosed. And we've been, you know, woefully criticized for requiring too much disclosures and the fact that financial statements now are people need a scale to weigh the size of these financial statements, et cetera. So we try to put that in as a general framework for people to evaluate whether they're, you know, just going overboard in terms of this disclosure or not going far enough. Whether it's helpful or not, I mean, I don't really know. We haven't seen the results of people trying to implement it and whether that phrase is causing difficulty in terms of preparers dealing with their auditors and auditors challenging their clients. So in terms of the specific reaction, I think we've received some mixed reaction. I think people have expressed some concern similar to the one you're asking about, and that is, you know, who's to make this determination? And we do have a separate project on disclosure, the disclosure framework. But again, that I can tell you that the staff has struggled with that because they've gone back. Initially, when they started the Disclosure Framework project, they went back to the very fundamentals of the conceptual framework in general, and that is, you know, what's relevant information, et cetera. And, you know, the board struggled with it, and we scratched our heads saying, you know, I don't know how people are going to use this. So I...
I didn't necessarily mean to imply a position, and I'll save that for later in the day. But it really does kind of raise the fundamental question of both judgment and principles versus rules.
Exactly.
And I was just curious as to what kind of reaction you were getting in comment letters, and then down the road, obviously, it will be a real question as far as both auditability and inspections and so forth.
Yeah, I agree.
Mike Gallagher.
Larry, I just wanted to first, you know, commend the FASB board. I think we've come a long way since last July, when I think you got an earful. You know, it's one of the few things I think there was a consensus on at the SAG where it was just too much. So I think you deserve high marks for listening and scaling back. I think the commitment to quality and stating the commitment to quality and then having that supported by the actions that you took in terms of coming down to a manageable, you know, number of exposure graphs on the key issues, I think, was really key. And the changes that you made, I think, to the existing exposure graphs, financial instruments, revenue, and leasing, I think have also been very positive in recognizing the practical without sacrificing quality in terms of, you know, the presentation. So you know, thank you very much for that. On financial instruments, I worry a little bit that you're out of alignment, you know, with the IASB. Maybe I'm being too generous by saying a little bit. But not only in terms of the concept, but in terms of timing. And I'm worried that you guys might find yourself in a little bit of a box if they get too far ahead of you on some things and maybe force you into an area or into some conclusions that you'd rather not or you wouldn't get to in your left to your own devices.
Well, first of all, thank you for the compliment. They don't come too frequently. In terms of financial instruments, I share your concern. Financial instruments is probably the most bothersome project from the standpoint that, given the financial crisis, I believe it was the most important project for the two boards to get on board together with. And it turns out to be the one where we probably have the greatest disconnect. So I think for a myriad of different reasons, it's a poster child for how not to do a convergence project. That being said, as I indicated, we are working hard together on impairment. Whether we get there or how we get there still remains to be seen, but we are, I think both boards have an objective of coming up with a converged solution impairment. At the same time, we recognize that neither of us is willing to sacrifice what either party considers to be the most quality standard. So we have a challenge in front of us. In terms of classification and measurement, the IASB has committed to taking whatever we come up with as our final document and exposing that in some fashion to get put a wraparound, similar to what we did with their proposal on derivatives and hedging activities. We're hopeful that they'll take that and do something with it. Now, the challenge is that thus far they've said, no, IFRS 9 is IFRS 9, and they're not moving off of it. And they've been particularly strong in those comments when it comes to discussing the insurance project, because clearly there are some easy answers you can get on insurance if they were willing to open up IFRS 9, but it remains to be seen as to whether they will do that. But we are hopeful that they'll see what our final package is and that they'll get comments that are positive and perhaps reconsider IFRS 9. In terms of hedging, as we have exposed their proposed document on hedging, which is you have to understand that when it comes to hedging derivatives and hedging activities, we're starting off at different places to begin with. But they've come up with a proposal that we have put a wrap around, and we've put forth a number of specific questions to see how our constituents would respond to their proposal. I suspect that we'll get a lot of positive reaction to their proposal because their proposal is a lot easier to implement than our proposal. But there are a number of problems with it, at least some people think so. And we will take the feedback that we get on that. We will participate in their redeliberations of their exposure draft, and then we'll just see, you know, see how it evolves from there. But, I mean, I understand your point. I find it very disappointing that both organizations, because of various different reasons and pressures on those organizations, were unable to to really deliberate together on a more timely basis. But I think both organizations recognize it, and there's a commitment to at least consider each other's views.